You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. Believing is Seeing, Part 4. In the last three episodes, I've been discussing how your eyes and brain work together to do their best to show you what's out there in the visible world. I've explained that your eyes are not passive cameras, taking in images with perfect fidelity. Rather, they are decidedly imperfect assemblies of photoreceptors, lenses, muscles, blood vessels, nerves, and energy-producing organelles that work together to gather what visual information they can and then pass it along to your brain, your amazing but fallible brain. Your brain then processes the information and presents it to you as a picture. This picture is meticulously constructed, pixel by pixel, for your use and enjoyment. It's based on what your eyes took in, plus your brain's own guesswork regarding what is really out there. This complex visual sensing system allows you to navigate the world, and also, sometimes, perform some pretty astonishing martial arts feats. But it's far from perfect, and the flaws in the system are openings which can be exploited, hacked into by those who wish to take your money, or gain influence over you, or make you look bad, or even defeat you in combat. These vulnerabilities have been exploited for centuries, even for millennia, by pickpockets, performing magicians, salesmen, demagogues, and in more violent encounters, mortal enemies. These people were not trained brain scientists, but humans have learned a lot about how to fool one another through the ages by simple trial and error. Trial and error is an achingly slow process, and error often leads to disaster. But over the long course of centuries and even millennia, succeeding generations of clever people have learned from their mistakes, and more importantly from the mistakes of their predecessors, and have developed numerous ways to get one over on you, or, with what we now know about brain science in mind, to hack into your brain. Most of these methods consist of tricks and techniques that get you, the sucker, or the victim, to make a change in how you're focusing your attention. Now, the human brain has two completely different modes of paying attention. The first is top-down attention. This is when you consciously decide to focus on something. The second is bottom-up attention. This is when your attention is suddenly, and usually involuntarily, seized by an outside stimulus. Anything that startles you, or suddenly evokes a powerful emotion like humor, anger, or sadness, is an immediate distraction from whatever you were paying attention to. This bottom-up form of attention is also sometimes referred to as surprise attention. In part two of this mini-series on human vision, I discussed your focal area, or that very small circle in the center of your field of vision that's only a tiny percentage of the total field, but is the only part of it in which you can see perfectly clearly, or at least as clearly as the level to which your vision has been corrected. I also mentioned that the focal area reminds me a bit of the depiction in the Lord of the Rings movies of the beam emitted from high atop the tower of Barad-dûr, representing the evil Lord Sauron's eye tracking the landscape like a searchlight. If you saw the movies and have a good mental picture of this, that's a pretty good visual representation of the way your focal area moves around your visual field. For our purposes today, let's call that focal area your attentional spotlight. Just where you point that spotlight is very important and is a vital part of the visual portion of your top-down attention. Another detail you may remember from Part 2 is that when you strongly focus your vision on whatever is in your attentional spotlight, your brain withholds information from what is in the remainder of your field of vision in order to keep you from being distracted. This is called inattentional blindness and is one reason why you often hear the word misdirection used in reference to stage magicians. A good magician will manipulate where you are directing your attentional spotlight in order to reduce your ability to perceive things that he does not want you to see, things that would only be visible in your peripheral field. Now, most of us think of our peripheral vision as being on the very edges of our visual field. But in reality, all of your visual field outside of that tiny attentional spotlight is peripheral vision. That's more than 95% of everything you think you see. The magician uses his skills as a performer to create an atmosphere that pulls you in, strongly motivating you to watch carefully to see how he performs his trick. This careful, top-down focus of your attentional spotlight is precisely what he wants. Based on what we know about the attentional spotlight and peripheral vision, the harder you look, the less you see. So the word misdirection means much more than simply tricking you into looking somewhere else. It also means that the magician tricks you into inattentional blindness to further seal the deal. What about bottom-up attention? Do stage magicians also exploit this as an additional tool against you? What do you think? Of course they do. Old-school magicians used a number of methods, including over-the-top loquacious patter, sudden dramatic gestures, puffs of smoke, or fireworks to stimulate the bottom-up response. Now, I'm fully aware that many of these tricks now seem cheesy to us in modern audiences. But you should remember that when much of stage magic was being developed, the audiences were far more poorly educated and less sophisticated than they are now. And what we might now think of as tired routines and stilted corny patter were pretty reliably hypnotizing to them, as often were the speech and mannerisms of any well-educated person. Modern magicians still engage your bottom-up attention, but in a markedly different series of ways. One of the most common is to make you laugh. That never goes out of style. Another method is to horrify you, or to frighten you. Penn and Teller are great examples of magicians using both horror and humor to engage your bottom-up attention. So you see, very good magicians occupy both of your forms of attention, often simultaneously. When they do this well, you don't have a chance. They have, in a cognitive sense, hog-tied you, blindfolded you, and stuffed cotton in your ears. With an audience in this state of mind, simple sleight-of-hand tricks are child's play. Skilled pickpockets also engage both of your forms of attention. A common tactic is for one pickpocket to engage your top-down attention by starting a conversation with you, or by showing you something interesting. Soon after this, his accomplice bumps into you, engaging your bottom-up attention for a split second, all the time the trained pickpocket needs to relieve you of your wallet or watch. As I frequently do on the martial brain, I will now try to bring the subject back to the martial arts. Many good fighters, whether they are consciously aware of it or not, use tactics that exploit these vulnerabilities of your perceptions. Back in the 70s and 80s, I did a great deal of sparring with a gentleman who had the distinction of having, in my opinion, the fastest initial move of any of the fighters I've ever trained with, and that's quite a list of talented people. It's difficult to explain in words just how heart-stoppingly explosive, how lightning fast this gentleman was. To paraphrase Bruce Lee, his strikes were frequently felt before they were seen. His first move was so sudden, so startling, and so completely, at least to my mind, non-telegraphed, that it took a lot of courage to spar with him, especially since he didn't mind hitting you hard. He wasn't the nicest guy I've ever known, but he had certainly developed a very effective fighting style. He simultaneously terrified and fascinated me. I wanted badly to learn to fight like him. I realized that I probably didn't have his genetic gifts, but his footwork, stances, and striking techniques were distinctly different from the styles I had studied, so I thought I could learn quite a bit from sparring with him and watching him spar with others. Over the next few years, I sparred countless rounds with him. I carry a few scars to this day from those rounds. I also had him spar with some of my top students, with their permission, of course, after carefully warning them what would happen, so that I could observe. The threat of his amazing initial speed definitely got the top-down attention of all of his training partners very quickly. Just like magicians and pickpockets, he would also frequently and simultaneously seize his opponent's bottom-up attention with tricks like sudden stomps of his foot on the floor or percussive slaps to his chest with his palm. He was particularly good at that. His hand slapping his chest sounded like a rifle shot. He stood so relaxed in his stance, with his eyes half shut as if he was about to fall asleep, that sudden changes in his stance also acted to seize his opponent's surprise attention. Since his blinding speed already had many of his sparring partners as nervous as the character Barney Fife from the old Andy Griffith TV show, these sudden visual and auditory cues were enough to make them jump out of their skin. Such sparring partners are easy marks for fakes and feints, especially combined with such amazing initial speed. Another martial arts form of seizing bottom-up attention that I've observed was used by my Muay Thai instructor, Surachai Sirisut. Ajarn Chai, or Master Chai, as we refer to him, is legendary for his speed. One expression of this speed happens when he holds focus mitts for students to punch. I've seen him hold pads for 30 or 40 students in a row at seminars for many years. If, when punching the pads, the student should leave an opening in his defense, Ajarn Chai will strike like a cobra into that opening with the mitt, often making a loud cracking sound as the flat leather of the pad strikes the student's head. As you would imagine, this gets Master Chai well inside the head of many of the people for whom he is holding the pads. He then will frequently engage their bottom-up attention in the middle of a focus mitt round by suddenly stopping and asking the student a seemingly irrelevant question. Something like, "How old are you, sir?" The student nearly always pauses, drops his hand a bit. His eyes look up as he momentarily thinks. Now, you would think most of us would be able to answer a question like, "How old are you?" instantly. But you've got to remember the state of mind that he has worked the student into. By this point, the student has become so focused on not getting hit that when they're asked an irrelevant question from out of the blue, it startles them. It takes them a moment to shift gears mentally and think of how to answer it. They usually drop their guard a bit as they do this and then manage to utter a single syllable, usually before Master Chai takes advantage of the fact that they've dropped their hands and cracks them in the head again. Another martial arts trick that bears resemblance to the misdirection used in stage magic has to do with footwork. Let me give you an example from fencing. Many fencing novices make the mistake of staring too intently at the tip of their opponent's weapon. This is a bad mistake, but it's understandable. After all, that's the business end of your opponent's weapon. But the distance between you and the tip of his weapon is not the only important distance to understand. A cagey veteran fencer, upon noticing that his opponent's attention is intently focused on the tip of his weapon, will subtly slide his rear foot up to his front foot. This is called a gaining step. The novice opponent is frequently unaware that this is happening because his attention is on the tip of his opponent's weapon. And as we now know, that blinds him to what is happening in his peripheral vision. This tactic creates an interesting illusion. To the eye of the novice, his opponent has not moved forward at all, because the tip of his weapon has not moved even 1 millimeter forward during this gaining step. But in the fencing lunge, the rear foot is the push-off point, and is the point from which you should measure your distance to the opponent. Having your rear foot closer to the opponent significantly extends how far you can reach towards them with a lunge, a fact of which the overly focused novice is fatally unaware. I've used a similar footwork trick to great effect in my kicking game for quite a long time. These have been just a few of what I am sure are myriad examples of how humans have figured out ways to hack into the brains of their martial arts opponents. And this concludes part 4 of Believing is Seeing. Anyway, That's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think, or check out old episodes of the Martial Brain Podcast at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for the Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.